The Florida Roundup, provided by the Litowitz Foundation in support of the highest quality programming to enlighten the public on important issues. Litowitz Foundation.
The Patricia and Philip Frost Art Museum at FIU invite you to the 9th annual Breakfast in the Park on Sunday, December 9th from 9:30 a.m. to noon. There will be a complimentary breakfast, an informal lecture by renowned sculptor Albert Paley, and guided tours of the museum and the sculpture park. Information at 305-348-2890 or thefrost.fiu.edu. That's thefrost.fiu.edu.
And good afternoon. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks for all of your pledges. And we're moving on. Thanks to you. And our weekly mission, we should tell you, is to keep South Florida informed on local and regional news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And we'll do that this week with Jane Wooldridge, who's editor of the Miami Herald's business section. She is coordinating also the paper's coverage of this week's Art Basel Miami Beach. As usual, very busy, but even more busy this week. Thanks for making out the time. A second time this week on these microphones, too.
Really happy to be here. It's a great week.
And Al Sunshine is also back with us. He is a longtime South Florida television reporter who specializes in consumer reporting for WFOR-TV in Miami. Al, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Chuck Strauss, a longtime local newspaper man, now editor-in-chief, El Jefe of the Miami New Times, has the El Jefe column in that paper. Welcome back to you, Mr. Strauss.
Great to see you, Phil.
And it is your show as well. We want to hear from you along the way. You can email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. That's thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. We're also lining up some calls and thoughts through the Public Insight Network, which if you are not a member of, you should be, because it is a terrific way for us to get your feedback and for you to sound off on issues that are important to us here in South Florida. You can do that by logging on to WLRN.org/insight, or also the Miami Herald has an insight way to sign up, and that's how we're going to get some of our feedback today, talking about prayer coming back to Miami-Dade Commission. And we'll actually start with that and set the discussion up and hear from some folks later on. Prayer returns to Miami-Dade meetings. Commission meeting starting December 18th. In an 8-3 vote on Tuesday, the Board of County Commissioners signed off on the change to the current rule that only allowed for a moment of silence before meetings. Now commissioners will be able to invite a religious leader of their choosing to lead everyone in a prayer before each meeting. Commissioner Pepe Diaz was a main proponent of the rule change, which was pushed by the Christian Family Coalition.
This is nothing new. 67% of municipalities in our community pray. All our levels of government, from the highest office, including the Supreme Court, pray. And they have the nominational people come in.
Miami-Dade is reinstating a policy of open prayer it last had in 2004. Remembering the past is longtime Commissioner Sally Heyman, who was among the trio that opposed the idea.
This county's strength is our diversity. And this ordinance likely will again become divisive as we allow people to speak with freedom and uncensored and can't control what they say.
So the prayers must be non-denominational, could be led by clergy or by the commissioners themselves. Chuck, you have come loaded for bear on this one. What you got?
Well, the ACLU was really pissed off about this proposed change. Not just the cost, but the fact that people would be praying in public. Miami-Dade, as they say in a letter they sent to him, is the face of the emerging new America. You know, America, I think, spoke in the election a couple months ago. We don't want religion mixing in with our politics. And I think the ACLU's taken a strong stand on it, and I'm with them.
Al, this is something that's been part of Miami-Dade's history. And as Pepe Diaz, Commissioner Diaz, pointed out, a lot of places are doing this. Why was this such a big story this week? And is there precedent that's possibly being set that's already being set, that's been set before in Miami-Dade County?
I think that this is probably, and again, this is just my opinion, I think that this is a road that communities have gone down in the past. I think it is a hot button issue. I think it is a political issue that is absolutely being promoted by a specific political base. I think in some ways, opening the door to this is going to set a course of motion with both the American Civil Liberties Union and a lot of other people to raise the question yet again of the propriety of mixing religion and government mixing people's personal beliefs with the public's business. And, you know, in the past, there's been some pretty solid road marks on what was acceptable and what wasn't. And this is probably going to be another issue where the community standard is going to be set. And if Commissioner Hammond is talking about it being a divisive issue, I think in a lot of ways she was probably very good at predicting what could be a very, you know, divisive court challenge and very divisive challenge both on the commission and within the different, you know, parts of this community.
Jane Wooldridge?
Well, this is, again, is my personal opinion, but my father was a minister, which not so many people know. I guess few more do now. And this is not something my dad would have agreed with, and I would be on that page. Government, people's personal beliefs are critically important, but they do not belong in a governmental role, and that's why we have a constitution that separates church and state.
All right, Chuck, go ahead.
I just want to say real quick, the ACLU has lawsuits pending already in California, Missouri, New York, Tennessee, and Florida. And the Metro Commission has been famous for throwing away our money by passing this bill. What they're doing is costing us more money.
They say it's $26,000 to form this database. I don't know how that get that stat. I didn't look into that closely. But commissioners, they say they'll actually do them themselves.
They threw that out. But what I'm saying is that the lawsuit that the ACLU is going to file against them is going to cost us a lot of money.
Right.
That's always frustrating, isn't it?
So we've asked you, and we've gotten a lot of response on our pin query this week about prayer and government, separation of church and state. We're going to return to this issue at the bottom of the hour and hear from some of our callers and some of our Public Insight Network members. So we'll put the comma right there and move on to state election reform. And the man charged with overseeing elections in Florida got an earful from state senators this week in Tallahassee over the state's voting trouble. Secretary of State Ken Detzner says 62 of Florida's 67 counties performed well during the general election, but there were a few notable exceptions that will lead to a fact-finding trip to Miami-Dade, Palm Beach, Lee, St. Lucie, and Broward counties, of course, the ones primarily here in South Florida. Detzner told the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee this week that Floridians cast a record 8.5 million votes, most for the first time, made up by absentee and early voting. But the fact that voters were waiting hours in line in places like Miami-Dade was unacceptable. And he says he's already met with Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez to discuss solutions. Detzner says there was a main culprit.
If there was one issue that stands out in terms of the length of time it took to vote, which was a contributing factor to the long lines, the long ballot was a major, the number one factor.
And a bad microphone apparently too there, but Miami Senator Miguel Diaz de la Portilla said the supervisor of elections in Miami-Dade could have opened additional early voting sites.
That supervisor of election chose to open 20 sites out of a potential at least 83, 84, or 85 early voting sites, right?
Yes, sir.
So the outcome of this investigation will be sent to the governor in January. Al, you've covered elections here for a very, very long time. Do you think that, I think there's a lot of finger pointing right now between state and local officials. How does this one compare to what you've covered in the past?
I think it stinks. I think that there was an organized effort to suppress the vote. I think that there was an organized effort by one political group to try to keep another political group from having a free, fair, open election. I think that if Tallahassee wants to come and see where the problem is, the first issue they should do is get a good set of mirrors up there and start looking at themselves in the eyes. I think very, very clearly a lot of the problems that we had in this state came from our main state political leadership, and I think that there was an absolute intent to suppress the vote down here. And is it a coincidence that the longest lines and the most problems from the communities that you just named may be some of the big urban areas? And without looking at the party affiliations, you have to raise the question of, was it a coincidence? I think not.
And by the way, some of the numbers bear this out. The voter turnout for the 2012 election fell to 71% in Florida. That was down from 75% in 2008. Chuck, any other way to interpret that than to blame it on the new election law?
Oh, I agree with Al that it was, Governor Scott was trying to get black and Hispanic voters out of the equation. I also, though, think everybody should remember that the Miami Herald just a few years ago won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing voter fraud in this community. I mean, this is, outside of Chicago, we have more dead voters than anywhere in America. And that needs investigation that needs changing.
What about local elections officials? I mean, how culpable are they in all of this? We just heard Diaz de la Partida say they should have opened more early voting sites. That obviously would have taken more resources. But again, it's a pointing fingers thing right now.
No, let's remember that Mayor Carlos Jimenez, a Republican, refused at first, at least, to open voting on the early voting places that needed an extension right before the election. Carlos Jimenez is the guy to blame. He's the number one Republican in Miami-Dade County, at least, and he ought to take some heat on this.
And here's one that we just saw this recently in the Palm Beach Post, actually the last couple of days. California Senator Barbara Boxer says she plans to introduce a federal voting law that would set national standards for determining the number of voting machines, election workers, and other resources needed to conduct federal elections. She obviously was thinking about what happened here in Florida. It would also mandate that voters wait in line no longer than 1 hour. What are the chances that the state of Florida would go along with federal election laws?
I can't imagine that would gain traction. But there is clearly something wrong in a scenario where you have people waiting in line for 6 or 8 hours, and then you have someone like actor Christian Slater, who can clearly prove who he is.
Right, lives in Miami-Dade.
Lives in Miami-Dade, whose vote gets thrown out. There's clearly problems here.
And Phil, let me tell you this, as far as public accountability goes, Florida has a very, very open government policy, the government in the sunshine policy, public records, public officials. By guidelines, reporters are not allowed to even observe the voting process inside precincts,
right,
but party officials, so-called poll watchers, are. And I don't think the public's interest has been taken into account by not allowing journalists to be able to report on these problems firsthand. I think that clearly needs to be addressed also.
Wait, you want reporters in the polling places?
Oh, my heavens.
I took out my iPhone when I think I was
poll
coming
watchers
in there.
Poll watchers are allowed. Party officials are allowed to observe the ebb and flow inside a poll. They're not allowed to talk to anybody. They're not allowed to politic, but they are absolutely, by law, allowed to sit in that poll, stand and observe the ebb and flow of the thing. Me as a journalist, I can't do that. And I think that the public's right is absolutely not being served by not giving me as a reporter the same access as a party official to observe the electrical process.
Al, the
you
big problem here
see,
is,
though, but go ahead, Chuck.
I just think the big problem is voting days and money, okay?
Clearly.
I mean, that's a side problem. Maybe it's an issue or maybe it's not, but Miami-Dade has had a problem for 30 years and has failed to solve it, and the mayor, who was clearly to blame, at least in our county, ought to go for that.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on 91.3 WLRN, 91.5 FM if you're in the Florida Keys. We thank you all for the pledges that were received before the show started. We're able to do this fundraising free because of that. I'm Phil Latzman, Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times. We've also got Al Sunshine from CBS4 Television, Jane Wooldridge from the Miami Herald. We're going to come back and talk about the climate change summit that's taking place in Palm Beach County and discuss a little bit about that, citizens insurance, all kinds of stuff we're teeing up for you. Stay with us. We're back in just a moment.
You can kick off your holidays early in Key West as the island comes alive with the holiday spirit. At kwholidays.com, you'll find many holiday events. The Key West Harbor Walk of Lights brings the waterfront alive every evening with the sparkle of holiday lights on the water. You can tour Victorian guest houses with their holiday decorations in full bloom on the Key West Holiday Historic Inn Tour. kwholidays.com for up-to-date details on all the holiday events in Key West. Brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Fair to Remember, a full-service off-premise catering company committed to making your event memorable anywhere in South Florida. Details on scheduling your event at 786-250-5387 and at fairtoremember.com.
The Gold Coast Jazz Society hosts free Friday jazz jams this Friday, today, December 7th, from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at ArtServe, 1350 East Sunrise Boulevard. Young jazz musicians jam with the pros. Details at goldcoastjazz.org. That's goldcoastjazz.org.
Stand by. Stand by, he says, and the mic is on. I'm Phil Latzman. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for joining us this Friday afternoon, or for the rebroadcast if you're up early on Saturday. I want to remind you that your questions are welcome for the panel. We're going to hear from some members of the Public Insight Network, but if you've got something to say and you want to email us at any time, thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. You can also ring us up on the phone at 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN, and we're tweetable. Call sign at WLRN is how you do that. I'm at Phil Latzman, and we do also have a Facebook page, which is the Florida Roundup on WLRN, and we do read that. We love the feedback we get from that page. We'll share some of that as well later on, so do like us on Facebook. Leaders from throughout the region are meeting in Jupiter this week for the fourth annual Regional Climate Leadership Summit, and the timing could not be better or worse, depending on your perspective, especially since Hurricane Sandy's passage. Signs of sea level rise can be seen all over South Florida, waves crashing over barriers and destroying coastal highway in Fort Lauderdale, massive beach erosion in Palm Beach, the ubiquitous flooded streets in South Beach. So is this the beginning of the end? I hate to sound that fatalistic about it, but it seems like we're sort of getting underwater here. What are businesses doing, or what are governments doing? What are businesses doing? Curtis Morgan is an environmental reporter for the Miami Herald, and he actually attended this regional climate leadership summit yesterday, and I'm actually going to be heading up there this afternoon to hear what's being said, but I wanted to hear what Curtis was hearing, because we did talk a lot about this on the show last week, and everybody can see it now. Curtis, welcome to the show, and what did you find out yesterday when you attended this summit?
Hi, Phil. What I found out was that they're ready to move from talking about it and planning things to actually doing stuff, and Sandy kind of underlined Sandy may not have been an effect of climate change, but it certainly underlined what the risks are associated with it in the future. And it was 4 years ago when Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, and Monroe got together to do something unprecedented in South Florida, agree to work together on something, and they wanted to address the risks of global warming. And at the time, most of the most immediate problems seem relatively obscure but serious, like saltwater intrusion in our well fields, and I guess the loss of the efficiency of some drainage gates along the coast. But Sandy has kind of underlined the worst case scenarios. So that's what they were talking about. What do we do next?
Now the fact that we can actually see it, I mean, where it's such a gradual story, it's so hard to cover, and I've covered it, you know, sporadically over the years, but now you're not henny-penny. I mean, you're seeing flooded streets, we're seeing beaches just kind of erode away, and infrastructure is disappearing. You know, it's just, it's there. I mean, people must be saying that this is the time we really need to get that message out.
I mean, some of this stuff has been happening for a long time. I forget which one was it? Ivan that cut some island on the southwest coast in half. I mean, this sort of destruction has been happening a lot, but not to the Northeast, which is the media capital of America and probably the political capital of America. So I think the timing of Sandy really woke up some eyes and sort of rekindled the conversation about climate change.
Yeah, that's interesting stuff. And you'll be writing about this for the Herald, so we can look forward to seeing your story about the climate change summit, and also be doing something for radio next week. Curtis, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
All right. So, so Jane, you have to think about this from a business perspective. So much valuable real estate that is being conceivably eaten away. Places like Miami Beach, South Beach, that are just underwater during certain tidal era at times. How do you not scare people off, tourists and even real estate people, when you deal with this problem?
Well, I think one of the lucky realities, and you know, to sort of go back, I mean, whether you believe in climate change or not, the reality is the most recent reports show that the polar ice caps, both ends, are melting at increasingly quick rates, and that it's now at historic levels. So the deal is they melt, we flood. I think that one of the things that has happened is, because South Florida has for so long been in a hurricane zone, we actually build here in a more responsible way we have had for a long time to rebuild our beaches. We don't really like to talk about it, but we do that. The flooding is the new thing, and I think that the best way to address from a business standpoint is to address it as quickly and you know, what kind of safeguards can we put in place. From a tourism standpoint, though, I would tell you that Venice is not suffering from its tourism numbers. I've been to Venice in the fall during the same thing. It's the floods. You wear hip waders. I'm not joking. You can rent them on the street. You pull them on. You can get the plastic throwaway version or the better version, the wellies. And you wander along on tables through St. Mark's Square because the whole thing's 3 feet underwater. That is an unfortunate look at things. I don't think going to the beach is quite the same, but whatever steps can be taken, I think it's in its own perverse way a good thing that people are finally saying, okay, this is a reality. Let's not just blow this off.
So good business idea, hip boot business.
Absolutely,
if you're in South Florida.
I'd be renting wellies.
What's funny is that, and we'll get into this FPL discussion in a little bit, but you know, talking about the nuclear power plants, Al, that are being in Turkey Point, that are being built, these extra reactors that FPL is now charging us for in advance, but that could be underwater. I mean, what are they building there?
That's talking about the anticipation of business for flooding, for floodplain consideration in this. And absolutely positively, you and I know that there will be a lot of extra expense incurred by FPL, perhaps that they may not even be anticipating today, to try to deal with the possible reality of, you know, absolutely needing to prevent flooding of a nuclear power plant. And look at, yeah, Turkey Point right next to Biscayne Bay. I shudder to think what would happen if Biscayne Bay were to raise another, 10 or 15 feet. What happens to Turkey Point? There's plans, but again, it is going to increase cost, and ultimately, especially with a public utility, who ends up paying those extra costs.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup, and that segues us right into the issue of citizens' property insurance. Governor Rick Scott says he's worried that citizens could cost Floridians money when they can least afford it, of course, after a major storm. He told the Florida Chamber of Commerce's annual insurance summit last week, the state insurer of last resort increases the chance Floridians will get hit with what he calls a hurricane tax. He said a survey showed 4/5 of citizens' policyholders did not know they're subject to an assessment if citizens comes up short and can't pay the claims, and he calls that a tax.
If a storm hits that depletes citizen surplus, either one big one or a lot of small ones, Florida families will get a hurricane tax. And that means the average family could have a hurricane tax, if you're a citizens' policyholder, of over $1,000.
The average citizen's policyholder pays a premium of $2,300. The great majority, he says, does not have another $1,000 in savings. But Al, you've done an extensive amount of reporting on citizens and how this is being handled in Tallahassee and how it's being perceived here in South Florida, where most of the citizens' property holders reside.
Well, first point, Citizens is on a tear, directly as a result of Governor Rick Scott's policy saying Citizens is too big, Citizens needs to be depopulated, Citizens needs to increase its revenues. Hundreds of thousands of policyholders, most of them in the South Florida area, will be issued transfer letters to put them into new companies that may have virtually no track record. We don't know if those companies are going to be around. It's a negative option. You don't have to positively affirm that you want to go. If you don't take action and you throw it in the garbage, you're automatically dumped. That's number one. Number two, the issue of Citizens doesn't have any money, Citizens is underfunded, Citizens has to raise rates. I believe they have, $60 billion in reserves. Yeah. And I believe also the governor and some special interests, the insurance industry, are desperately trying to get their money on our public fund reserves. So at one hand, you have the governor, in my opinion, saying that Citizens has too much risk, Citizens has to be depopulated,
right,
Citizens needs to raise more money for more private companies. And on the other hand, conservatives don't want to look at it, but are we in the process of using public tax dollars for an insurance industry bailout using our safety net to try to give more insurance companies money. And then you get to the whole issue of, look at the executive compensation, look at the ridiculous amount of money that Citizens has wasted on lawsuits and other issues that the Miami Herald and other newspapers around the state have absolutely done phenomenal reporting on. You ask the question, why is it happening? And you look again at Tallahassee, where 5 out of 15 members of the House Financial and Insurance Committee have direct ties, their insurance industry executives. I cannot stress enough, this is not a coincidence. We are being absolutely manipulated by the industry and by the lobbyists.
And meanwhile, everybody's insurance rates are going up significantly. Every Citizen's property holder.
Ours is going up 104%, and my husband is, screaming at the top of his lungs. But there has been significant mismanagement in Citizens Fund, aside from the issues that we have written about. And by the way, we wrote about the shenanigans that have gone on, the payoffs to people who were, should have been fired without a payout. Right. And,
$750,000.
And the media got slammed in a meeting for reporting this stuff. I mean, there aren't printable words for that. But beyond that, think about this. Okay, Citizens was set up as a hurricane insurer, a windstorm insurer of last resort. Then they added in sinkholes. Now, sinkholes are actually the bigger draw off the fund than windstorm has been in recent years. So where's the logic here? And the reality is there is none. And if Sandy brings up one thing that maybe could bring an improvement
National
to America,
Catastrophe
it's
Fund.
National Catastrophe Fund.
Sorry,
that's
I
it.
Sorry, take the words out of your
no,
mouth.
No, you're right on.
The citizens of the state of Florida cannot afford to fix an industry-wide problem. There is no affordable insurance anywhere in the United States for windstorm, and I think Sandy, as you well brought up, should be the clear signal that it is a national problem that requires a national solution.
And Chuck, final word on this?
Oh, I was just going to say, this is another example of Rick Scott's misguided, unethical, ham-handed leadership of the state of Florida. He starts talking about we need to fund these guys more, we need to move more people out, and he doesn't dig into the corruption in that has been, as Al said and Jane said, has been well documented in that company. Scott ought to go, and he ought to go quick.
All right, that's the second person you've said that
exactly.
about today.
Jimenez, Scott, goodbye.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. That's Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times. His opinions are his own. Jane Wooldridge is with the Miami Herald. She's the business editor and leading the Art Basel coverage. We'll talk about that a little bit coming up in the show. And also with us, and great to have him back, is Al Sunshine from CBS 4 Television. I'm Phil Latzman. Now, we did talk at the beginning of the hour about the prayer in Miami-Dade and really the role of prayer in government, religion in government. And we asked members of the Public Insight Network and our Facebook page what role prayer had in their lives and whether there was a place for it in government and public hearings. And we got a lot of feedback from folks. So one of them through the Public Insight Network is Raul Jesus Cernuda, who wrote, is Raul actually on the line or no? No, he actually wrote us. A moment of silent meditation is an excellent compromise for all. I wish we as a society could finally get over this nonsense and focus on real issues such as unemployment, property values, the terrible state of our economy, or blatant corruption and mismanagement in our local governments. Pray for sanity. Well, that's one thing they could start, praying for at the beginning. Chuck,
Listen, there are more people I think ought to go. Okay, so let me just start. I think that they're I think he's right on. I think they're wasting our time with a dumb issue. A moment of silence is just fine.
But what I think he's saying is, silent meditation. All right, so wait a second. Now, who do we have here? Oh, let's talk to Juan, who's on the line from Miami. Juan, I got you mixed up with Raul. Juan, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Now, you support this, correct?
I think it's a great step towards, bringing a little sense of godliness into our world. I'm not overtly, religious, but I believe, I don't see people not taking dollar bills.
Right. Well, what does that have to do
because
with...
Because they say, in God we
in
trust.
God in God we trust. Okay.
In God we trust. And the reality is, when everyone complains about, society and the lack of morality there is, and the fact that, there's prayer you know, equates to at least having some type of faith in the future. And I see the opposite of not having any type of prayer or anything else as another belief, which is, you know, the belief that there is nothing to pray about and you know, you don't idolize anything, which is also a belief. So, I mean,
good point.
If we're not praying, or I mean, and I understand the moment of silent meditation, but being a kid of that grew up in the 80s, I will tell you that I saw how, you know, we went from prayer to meditation to a moment of silence to basically chaos and shootings and total corruption. And when there's a storm coming, you know, the commissioners stand there with the mayor and, they ask for prayer.
Wait, Juan, you're saying that because we stopped praying in the 80s, that all these shootings started happening in crime group?
I believe scientifically, you know, there's no study yet, but I will tell you from, I was a teacher for a while, and I've seen the lack of morality and the lack of, you know, respect. Granted, this should be taught by parents, but I think the church or the synagogue or any institution that has, you know, faith as its basis creates this type of, you know, necessity for people to be good. And, you know, if there was something else we could do, I would definitely side with it.
Juan, let me ask you this. I see this as the Jewish perspective, growing up and being involved at, you know, saying grace before a meal and sort of not feeling it like I was included or that I belonged. And I feel that if you're sitting in one of these commission meetings and there's an invocation and you sort of feel like you're not part of that, you feel excluded. I think that's maybe what people are a little concerned about. It is not necessarily an ecumenical or just, you know, if you have a silent prayer, you can think about whatever you want. Whereas you speak it out loud, other people might get offended or excluded.
Can I tell you something? And I believe what you're saying 100% because I was in that realm myself. I did Holocaust studies at UM through the county public schools. And I've come to understand, because I go to synagogue too, as much as I go to Catholic church and, you know, been to Baptist, is that when I hear a prayer, I'm not thinking about, you know, just my God, whatever I idolize. I'm thinking about, you know, just the goodness in thinking there is someone that watches over us. Yeah. So when I go to synagogue, and I mean, I can't read because, you know,
neither can I.
Your scripture is. But you know what? I feel the sharing, and I think that's the goodness that prayer brings. And whoever thinks it's just aimed at your God, then they just need to grow as an individual.
Juan, well said. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
All right. Art, I don't think, has the same opinion. He joins us also via the Public Insight Network. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. Hi, Art.
Hi. Hello. Good afternoon.
So, did you hear what Juan had to say?
Yes. Yes. I think that, you know, no one, no matter what religious beliefs they have, should really be offended if someone decides to invoke a prayer. I don't think it's something that's actually meant to be exclusionary. You know, we're trying to call on a greater power, the maker, the creator, as the Masons call it, the architect of the universe, for recognition, perhaps, and assistance in, you know, day to day.
All right, Art. Thanks for the call. Let's see if I can sneak in another person who wrote us. Lauren from Miami is a teacher at a Catholic school. She does not think that the silence was discriminatory. She writes that, quote, prayer has a very large role in my day-to-day life, but while I believe in Christian values and morals, I do not believe that any religion belongs in government. That's sort of what you were telling us before about your father, who was a minister, Jane.
Yeah, I just, you know, but my point of view is that it doesn't belong in government. But I have to say that I do appreciate the desire for civility, because it is something that is being lost. And, you know, maybe this moment of silence is that compromise that gives people the opportunity to think about things in their own way, but brings that civility. But I can really appreciate the desire for that.
And then there's a whole another issue about people who don't agree with the separation of church and state, that separation shouldn't mean that there can't be nativity scenes and menorahs and Kwanzaa displays, like, you know, in Santa Monica. I think they've started to outlaw and ban those too. So, you know, the other side will say, well, you're taking that away, then you'll take this away. So it's a very sensitive issue when you're dealing with public entities.
It's a tough issue. I'm sort of ecumenical, so I would say bring all the holiday celebrations celebratory items on. And in that vein, last night I was at an Art Basel event, and there were two camels, live ones. They live in South Dade. And it was happened to be a celebration of Jewish culture, which was a great event. And then those camels were going on to nativity scenes. So the camels have got it right.
All right. Well, that, and we're going to talk about the Art Basel scene in just a moment. In fact, I'm going to apologize to Terry and Jim. Should we hold them? Let's just hang in there, guys. We may return to this. It's a very visceral issue, as we can hear. We've heard some good points on both sides. You're listening to the Florida Roundup. I'm Phil Latzman, Jane Wooldridge from The Herald. Also with us, Al Sunshine from CBS 4 Television and Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times. We'll come back, and Jane, she's the Art Basel queen. She's got all the information on what you should see and what it means to our community. We're back with that in just a moment.
This week at O Cinema Miami Shores, Helen O tells the story of Brazilian athlete Helen O de Freitas' rise to superstardom in the 1940s. A true story of fame, fortune, decadence, and passionate love affairs. Details at o-cinema.org.
What may be South Florida's most beloved holiday tradition returns December 8th through the 18th with Seraphic Fire's Grammy-nominated Candlelight Christmas Concerts. Timeless carols and beautiful Gregorian chant combine into a concert experience the Miami Herald calls gorgeous and evocative. There are performances across South Florida. Two concerts are already sold out. Tickets at 305-285-9060 or seraphicfire.org.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Lincoln, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2013 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. Introducing the Lincoln Motor Company. More at Lincoln.com.
And we welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Good comment from our Facebook page this week. Got some really good stuff from Facebook on this. Todd writes, I don't have a problem with prayer. Heck, I've even heard they have special places for people to congregate and pray together. Now imagine the Miami-Dade County Commission does for prayer what it did publicly for publicly funded sporting facilities. Remember how that turned out. And we are going to continue to follow the issue. Thanks, Todd, for that. Those comments, most of them from the Public Insight Network and our callers. And if you'd like to sign up for the Public Insight Network and be involved in that discussion, be our informed army, it's WLRN.org/insight. Thank you so much for all your input this week on that. Do you know how it's tourist season in Miami? Where you just sort of see random acts of art appearing, like giant pink snails on Miami Beach or barge with a 100-foot alligator. Well, that's Art Basel Miami time. The 11th edition of Art Basel, called by organizers, quote, this is from their website, the most prestigious art show in the Americas, features more than 260 leading galleries from North America, Europe, Latin America, Asia, and Africa taking part, showcasing works by more than 2,000 artists of the 20th and 21st century. Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau President Bill Talbert says it has completely transformed our region's cultural scene.
In the space of art and culture, where we were a wasteland before, nobody in the past would have visited Miami because of art and culture. Nobody. And now, we're the center of the world for this weekend for art.
Jane, you're reacting to that statement by Bill Talbert.
Well, Bill and I agree and disagree on different items over the years. And the one I disagree about, this was not a cultural wasteland. And there were people who came here for arts before Art Basel. The fact that it's exponential now is absolutely true. If you saw a story we did earlier this week, hotel rates are through the roof. You cannot get a hotel room in this town this weekend. The economic benefits of Art Basel Week are, we've never been able to exactly quantify them because the receipts are so high in the month of December anyway. But this year, I think we will be able to quantify it a different way. You can't look at it via taxable sales, even on the art, because if the artwork's being delivered out of country or out of city, the taxes don't show up. But what I will tell you is that the part that you read is about the Art Basel Fair proper, and right. that is
that's
accurate,
not,
by the
it's
way.
It's not everything else. The satellite fair
and
is everything
else. And I think it becomes really confusing for people. Art Basel is a privately owned fair that came here, chose Miami with help from a bunch of Miami collectors who were really keen on this. And they already had an art scene here, which is why Art Basel came here. But then beyond that, that fair is so prestigious and brings such high-end collectors that it has morphed into a scenario where it includes the where other people have piggybacked, coattail effect in the political world.
I'm with Howard. I think that they used to say that Miami Vice was the show that Miami invented and that reinvented Miami. And I think Art Basel, in a way, has done the same. It's reinvented the city, which was not known for its culture. It was known for its cocaine, and it was known for its, you know, crime and
by
drugs.
By you Philistines, and that's probably true,
but
Chuck.
It is known internationally in Europe and around the world as an art center, and that is really an interesting transformation.
It is an important transformation, but it was not only Art Basel.
All right, Al Sunshine, you've been around this town for a long time. Very impressive that Al covered the Democratic and Republican national conventions in Miami Beach in 1972. He went to school coming right out of UM, so you've been around this town for a while, 40 years at least, covering news here. Was this place Nowhereville when it comes to art and culture 40 years ago?
I'm going to swim upstream. I'm going to be the counter voice here, and I could tell you that I enjoyed many, many years ago going to the Gleason Center to see Broadway road shows. I could tell you many, many years ago with the Miami Ballet and Edward Viella, it was a internationally known ballet group. I think the absolute vibrance of the Hispanic community, I think the absolute vibrance of, you know, a lot of the emerging Haitian and Caribbean artists down here. I think that we as Anglos tend to be egocentric, and I think that we tend to forget that for a long time, Miami has earned its reputation as a cultural center of the Americas, and it might not be the traditional culture that we might be used to, but I think Miami had a very special flavor going years ago that contributed very much to where it is now.
Al, if you go to Buenos Aires and you look at the theater, the art in the street there, it's a vibrant Latin art community. Miami has pieces of Latin culture and Latin art, but they're tiny compared to the meccas of Latin art culture. And it's still, if we have a failure, I think it's that part of our community, which is more than 50%, has failed to show itself in... Or we failed to show it, maybe, in the art scene that has grown.
And I am going to completely disagree with you. Okay, I have just come from CIFO, which is the Cisneros Institute, that's a free public, I'm sorry, it's a free private museum. Ella Cisneros, her collection, she has funded it. It is all Latin American art, not Cuban art, not this art, not that art. Latin American art. Ran into architect Enrique Noten on the sidewalk, and we're talking, and he's doing four projects here. He's based in Mexico City, and he says to me, one of the reasons I love coming to Miami is culturally it is so comfortable for me. And I said, yeah, language really isn't an issue. His English is better than mine, of course. And he says, no, I mean culturally. It has nothing to do with language. That this has become such an international city.
More than just Latin America or the Americas.
Not,
we're talking about
yes,
around the world.
Yes, it's not just Latin American. It's not just Caribbean. It's not just European-centric. It is now unlike any place. And as you know, Chuck, I've done a little bit of traveling in my day. And there is no place like this. Some days that's not always for the better. But most days it is, and this week it is.
More than 50% of our community is Hispanic, and most of those were born outside the United States. Yet, there's very little Latin theater. There's very little even at the Miami Book Fair, which is a great thing, there's not enough Latin stuff. That part of our community, outside of these public-private museums, has not got a platform yet, and that's the next step.
We're dealing with limited time here, but there's a couple more things that I wanted to get to with Jane. The fact that, first of all, the appeal of Art Basel, does it extend outside of Miami and Miami
Beach?
Does it extend up to Palm Beach, where they're probably listening going, what's this Art Basel stuff?
Well, here's where I'll tell you it does extend to, and that is Paris. And I was talking to somebody last night, and they said, they came in for business reasons for the fair, and they said, everybody in Paris knows Basel. They were also jealous that I was coming here. If you go to any of these events, there are people from all over the world, and if you are from Palm Beach County, you get to be included in that all over the world, and you should come. And for people who've never done any of the Art Basel activities because they find it overwhelming, my advice is pick one thing and do that. And if you've never done any of it, my first choice would be the big fair in the convention center on Miami Beach.
Oh, and that leads us to the last question about this, is there's all this attention to the high-profile art purchases out there, but haven't you always said that the best stuff is actually the free stuff?
Many, many of the great things at this are free, and one of them happens tomorrow night. There is the Art Basel people are giving us this gift of an all-night film at the New World Symphony Wallcast. Starts at 6 p.m., runs till 6 a.m.
Wow.
There are films. There are video programs. There is free sculpture. There's the Gator in the Bay, which is going to be making its rounds over the weekend. There
and tomorrow night is Art Walk in Wynwood, so every gallery in Miami will be open, and every food truck's going to be there, and it's like the biggest party of the year.
There are many things this week that are absolutely free that are just incredible. Some of them incredible good, some of them not, but all thought-provoking, which is the idea behind art in the modern world.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup. That's Jane Wooldridge with the Miami Herald. She's been coordinating the paper's coverage of Art Basel this week. Also with us, Al Sunshine from CBS4 Television and Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times. Now, speaking of the Miami Herald, as we pivot on to another thing that Miami might or might not want to be in the future, and that is a place where resort casinos will be located. The casino giant that bought the Miami Herald site has put on hold its plan to petition for a casino amendment on the 2014 ballot. The Malaysian-based casino giant Genting Group has already spent close to $1 million on a campaign to let voters decide in 2 years on the ballot, but they are halting the petition to let state lawmakers decide whether to bring Las Vegas-style gambling to Florida. And now they're taking a less aggressive strategy. Al is sort of somebody that's seen the story develop and very familiar with the Herald building and what it means and what it doesn't mean. How do you see this sort of ending up in the future with this casino resort gaming, and will it be on that site?
I think that there is going to be a colossal political, moral fight in this state, pitting again the northern part of the state being a lot more conservative with the southern part of the state, which is going to be a lot more liberal. I think that probably Genting has realized that the fight has got to be in Tallahassee. And I think that the only way that we would expedite getting the casino gambling down here in the light of the present political climate of the rest of the state is draw the line between Orlando and Tampa and come up with a whole new state in South Florida. I think eventually there is going to be a real, real reality that to compete economically, to compete with other destinations around the world, there needs to be some really serious discussions one way or the other. But I don't think it's going to be easy. And I think with the political climate of the rest of the state, it's going to be a very, very uphill battle.
So let's be clear. You want to separate the state at I-4, say perhaps South Florida below that and North Florida above that, just make it 50 and 51st states? Or is that what you're proposing?
I think
that'd
be a great story to debate and talk, and it'll keep us busy for a long time in the future.
Genting has taken the long-term view here. They're not going to get all the voters in the state to vote for them. That's what they're doing. So they're backing up. They know that with their money, they can have significant influence in Tallahassee, and then they're going to move out from there.
And I'm going to make a different prediction. And this does not come off of any information, and you guys are going to laugh at me a year from next. I'm going to turn out to be wrong. But what I think is going to happen is I think real estate values have appreciated significantly, that Genting is looking around, is deciding that this fight is going to cost them, in terms of headache power as well as money, rather a lot. And I predict that someone else will own that piece of land a year from now.
Well, Genting has said very specifically that they're going to go ahead and develop that property whether or
not they're going to build it no matter what the Florida legislature approves. They're moving ahead with plans to turn the waterfront into a resort. And that leads us to, whether the Miami's Historic Preservation Board will declare the Miami Herald building an historic site, some size and grins. Now, Greg Allen did a story for NPR on this. Both of you, and I think I work at the Herald, Al is the outside party observer here. Is the Miami Herald worth preserving, the building itself?
I'm going to swim upstream on this. I thought that the Orange Bowl should have been on the historic list of register.
Yes.
I thought that there was absolutely a lot of history in that old building. I think that... the Knights, as far as American journalism goes, and I think as far as Miami journalism goes, there's a real good discussion for perhaps thinking about preserving that and bring it up on the table.
Okay. It's building in South Florida.
It's this
blocky, crappy thing that blocks the view.
And by the way, my office is in an electrical closet. I think we should get a huge statue of John Stuart Knight there.
Well,
and here's what I'm going to vote for. I'm going to say that I think the community is best served by giving whoever eventually builds on that site a clean slate to build on.
All right, finally, we're going to end with this. Now, the Heat has not looked good the last couple of games. They had an embarrassing loss to the NBA's worst team, the Wizards, the other night. Then they lost by 20 to the Knicks last night. But Heat MVP LeBron James, who led Miami to an NBA title this year, named this week by Sports Illustrated as its 2012 Sportsman of the Year.
I mean, it's an unbelievable list. And so many other great athletes that's, laid the path for guys like myself. And it's very overwhelming.
He helped, of course, the U.S. win gold at the Olympics. He's been honored for his charitable work involving school children in Akron, Ohio. Dwayne Wade won this award in 2006. Now, I know, Jane, you love LeBron. I mean, if you have a perspective that other people don't, because everybody hates him, but
I love LeBron. Listen, I think the guy has done a lot of. He's really smart. He's done a lot of great things for our community. You got to remember, he's young. And I think he's amazing, and so I say go LeBron.
And by the way,
I want to swim upstream with Al here. I say trade Dwayne Wade. I say it's time for the Heat to dump Dwayne Wade and find a younger superstar.
Oh boy, you're finishing off in a flurry.
Jimenez, Scott, Dwayne Wade. Goodbye to all.
There you go. What a way to end the show. Chuck Strauss from the Miami New Times. Always a pleasure and entertaining to have you part of this panel. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Phil.
Al Sunshine from CBS4 Television sitting back going, what am I doing here, right? No, Al, it's
a pleasure. It's great to be here.
It's fun to be here. We always love to have you, too. And then Jane Wooldridge, so engrossed in Art Basel coverage this week, but able to come on WLRN twice in 1 week.
It's been fun.
Thank you so much. It's been fun. And that does it for the Florida Roundup. I'm missing my credits, but I think I know everybody that works on this show pretty well. Paul Leary is our technical director. Wonderful job out of him. Elaine Chen, one of our producers, an extremely hardworking young lady. Thank you. Alicia Zuckerman also produces the show. Peter J. Meritz, our WLRN program director. Dan Gretsch handles things for WLRN Miami Herald News. Who else am I leaving off? Steph Farrow for helping us on the Public Insight Network. How about her? That'll do it. Yeah, all right. We want to tell you that the show is broadcast back tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. You might be listening to it live. Ed Bell's got live music for South Florida Arts Beat coming up next. Seraphic Fire, you don't want to miss that. Thanks for listening. I'm Phil Latzman. Stay informed, South Florida.